I was listening to your podcast and I was really disappointed. I got immediately outraged when I heard your throwaway comment. It just seemed like lazy reporting. A really quick Google search would show you how badass banana slugs actually are.
This is Every Little Thing from Gimlet Media. I'm Flora Lichtman, and I just want to get on the right side of slug history. On last week's show, we passionately championed the flamingo and argued for the flamingo mascot, which I stand by 100%. But in the course of that campaign, I put down UC Santa Cruz's banana slug mascot. And kind of to my delight, we have gotten an avalanche of hate mail about it.
Laura, how could you throw shade on the banana slug?
She goes, there's some lame mascots out there, and I could just tell it was. I knew it was coming.
It was in the tone. You cannot disrespect the slug. What else would you want for a mascot? Let there be slug.
This is what I want to say about it. I feel like people who have written in are totally right.
Yeah, you don't need to put one creature down to lift another one up. They can all be awesome.
That's right. So I get that. And I actually feel true shame about this. And I want to make it right.
There are so many interesting things about banana slugs.
This is Stella Harris. Stella has had a lot of experience with the banana slug mascot as a UC Santa Cruz alum. And what I learned from Stella is that the mascot is a total cultural phenomenon.
This cultural icon makes an appearance in the film Pulp Fiction, where John Travolta's character wears a UC Santa Cruz banana slug shirt in the movie.
Damn.
In 2008, ESPN named it one of the 10 best college mascots. People Magazine has done a full-page spread on the banana slug movement. The National Directory of College Athletics named it the best mascot, and Sports Illustrated Magazine named the banana slug the nation's best college nickname.
I'm such an idiot. Oh my God.
Is this explaining why you got so much mail?
It's explaining several things. Yes. And the way that the banana slug became a mascot is this triumph of student organizing. So it was this unofficial mascot on the campus for years. Then in 1980, when UC Santa Cruz wanted to join the NCAA, the application required an official team name.
And so the school chancellor at the time selected that they would be the Sea Lions. So that was met by a great deal of protest from the students.
What was the sentiment driving the battle for the slug?
One of the many things about Santa Cruz, there was this sort of backlash to the jock or sports or frat culture at a college. And so embracing the banana slug as the mascot was sort of a way to tell off that, you know, hyper masculine culture around sports.
The banana slug is like the flamingo. So anyway, the UCSC students campaigned for the slug, and it took 5 years of protesting.
The students won over the chancellor, and they made the banana slug the official mascot.
And that is the amazing origin story of the banana slug mascot. But the slug love extends way beyond the mascot. The banana slug itself, the slimy yellow creature, also has a following.
They're kind of a cult thing out here. It's like being down on pandas or moose in Maine or something.
This is zoologist Janet Leonard from UCSC. Should we introduce you on the show as a slug expert?
You could.
Banana slugs live on the West Coast in redwood forests, and they're about the size and shape of a banana. And one of their special abilities is that they can eat almost anything.
Well, they'll eat roadkill. There's no problem with that. They're famous also for eating death angel mushrooms.
That's hardcore.
And poison oak.
They can eat poison oak?
Yeah.
It slithers along the ground by producing this mucus that's kind of a marvel of natural engineering.
And actually, the way these guys crawl is they lay down a layer of mucus and then sort of glide over it.
Like a slip and slide?
Yeah.
But that is not all. Banana slugs have this whole other claim to fame.
This is like a dual interest for me because I'm a professional sex educator. And so anecdotes about sex things are part of what I do for a job. So the ways that banana slugs have sex is actually one of the most fascinating things about them.
If you're listening with kids, now is the time to decide how much you want them to know about slug anatomy.
Are you prepared for banana slug sex?
I was born ready, Stella.
They have very elaborate sex organs and a very elaborate mating behavior. They do about 2 hours of courtship behavior.
2 hours?
About 2 hours, yeah.
That's long.
Well, yeah, but it works for me.
When you say elaborate sex organs, what do you mean?
Yeah. Well, they have a very large penis, which extended can be about twice the length of the animal.
So an average banana slug penis is longer than an average human penis.
I guess there's like nothing else to say.
They're simultaneous hermaphrodites. They have a penis and they have a vagina.
And they have sex in the 69 position and mutually penetrate each other.
I like the fluid rolls.
So then it takes a dark turn after that.
The two species that have the longest penis also have a behavior we call apophallation.
Oh, no. What is that?
Well, sometimes at the end of copulation, the penis gets amputated.
How? How does it get amputated?
The partner reaches over and chews it off.
Stella, what do you think the banana slugs teach us?
I think the lesson is that there's a lot of different ways that you can have sex. And unlike the banana slugs, I think you should probably check in with your partner before any kind of sexual activity, but especially if you're going the apophallation route.
After the break, we're going to ruin my childhood memory. What type of librarian are you? Like, how would you describe yourself as a librarian?
I would say defiant and innovative. You may also have heard the term pain in the ass.
Who are you a pain in the ass to?
Well, I think I know this is old-time language, but to what might be called the library establishment.
I didn't even know there was a library establishment.
Oh, there is indeed. Yes, there is. Yeah. Yep.
This is Sandy Berman. He's a librarian and cataloger. And he's also this kind of culty figure in the library universe. Like, he has a following.
The name has been in the past, and not at my instigation, Sandinistas.
Sandy has been fighting a quiet war against the library establishment for 50 years. The battlefield? The library catalog. Okay, here's what you need to know. There are two main cataloging systems in this country. There's the Library of Congress system, and there's the Dewey Decimal system. Both categorize books under subject headings, and they're often really outdated. Which may not sound particularly enraging, but let me tell you, it fires Sandy up.
For a long, long time, believe it or not, anybody looking for material in the catalog under toilets, like, for instance, a plumbing manual, would be compelled to find it under the LC, the Library of Congress heading, water closets.
What?
And yes.
Sandy attacked the problem by publicly ridiculing the Library of Congress. And for Battle Toilet, he won. He was in the audience at a library conference when he found out about his sweet victory.
And what came out of my mouth pretty loud, I said, I'm flushed with pride.
I'll bite.
All right.
But But this is bigger than toilets. Seriously, Sandinistas have been working to change the heading illegal aliens to non-citizens and unauthorized immigration. Sandy got the heading hermaphrodite changed to intersex. In the Dewey Decimal System, he got homosexuality moved out of the medicine category. And he's also campaigned to add new categories.
These are matters of serious public policy discussion right now. Mass incarceration. We read and hear about that, at least I do, just about every day. But there's no heading for it.
Here's why it matters. What categories are in the cataloging systems and how they're worded subtly sends a message about what's important and what isn't. And think about the reach. Basically, every kid in America is exposed to the Dewey Decimal System in school. And actually, it's global. Dewey is the most widely used library classification system in the world.
It's a kind of a hidden power that people haven't recognized.
That's library historian Wayne Wiegand. He wrote a book on Dewey.
For example, when was your first exposure to the Dewey Decimal Classification Scheme? Was it at the public library? Was that at your school library?
It was at my school library.
Okay, so that's your first exposure. To what extent did that exposure determine for you how you perceive knowledge to be organized?
It's a good question, and here is an example of what Wayne is talking about. In the Dewey Decimal System today, under the category religion, there are these subcategories: philosophy and theory of religion, the Bible, Christianity and Christian theology, Christian practice and observance, Christian pastoral practice and religious orders, Christian organization, social work and worship, history of Christianity, Christian denominations, other religions.
There is a priority system built into that classification scheme.
This category structure strongly suggests that there is a lot to learn about Christianity and way less to learn about the rest of the world's religions.
And how has that influenced you for the remainder of your life?
You're right. It's like mind control at your most vulnerable time. It's when you're learning about what is important and you're getting this subconscious message from your library about how to organize this information
Indeed.
Around you.
And you use the term mind control. I'm kind of stepping back away from it, recognizing that there is this compelling need to organize. The algorithms built into Google, for example, are also by your use of the term mind control.
That's an interesting comparison because the Dewey Decimal System takes a lot of data and organizes it. It's like an early algorithm. And the early tech bro behind it was a guy named Melville Dewey.
I describe him as a tightly wrapped individual.
The Dewey Decimal System was created by this kind of rogue reformer who thought he could change the world. Melville Dewey's obsession? Efficiency.
To the point where he had extra pockets sewn into his coats, where he used particular colored pens for particular kinds of notes. Saving time was very much a part of what he did with almost all of his life.
Why was his name spelled Melville, M-E-L-V-I-L?
Well, it started out being M-E-L-V-I-L-L-E, and then he was also a proponent of simplified spelling. He thought if the American English language could be simplified, it would cut 2 years off of an elementary education.
Wait, let me get this straight. He dropped the last two letters of his first name as
yes.
a time saver.
Yes.
Dewey was ahead of his time on the life hacking. But in 1873, he found a bigger innovation target than his coat pockets. The outdated industry he wanted to disrupt was the library.
And he thought it was reprehensible that libraries across the country would have separate classification systems. His idea was, let's have just one classification system so only one person had to classify and everybody else could adopt the system.
So this guy who is obsessed with efficiency, who believed in his own ability to change the world, he also believes that he's in a super good position to organize all the world's information into categories.
And at times, Flora, you can almost call it arrogance, the cultural arrogance.
Dewey's system purported to organize all information into 9 neat categories. It has since been expanded to 10 categories. Major headings are coded by 3 digits, and decimals allow for ever-expanding subcategories. And the way that Dewey chose to classify information had a lot to do with his worldview.
So he had racist attitudes. He had anti-Semitic attitudes, not unlike the people he associated with. He certainly was a sexist in that he thought women had a particular role to play in life. He very frequently violated what I call the Victorian social standards.
Like what kind of violations specifically?
Well, the laying on of hands, unwelcome hands. Oof. There were several of his secretaries who brought suits against him. Their claim was he put his hands on them and he kissed them on occasion, and they didn't want that. Now, by 21st century standards, those certainly are sexual harassment activities.
The way that Dewey thought about other people was reflected in the catalog system. Dewey's prejudices and the prejudices of people like him at that time showed up throughout the system.
So let's say W.E.B. Du Bois's very famous book, Souls of Black Folk, which was published, I think, in 1903, if I'm not mistaken. When the Dewey Decimal Classification classified it, it had no category for African Americans. So it was categorized with another number assigned to something like primitive cultures. It wasn't until the third or fourth revision of the Dewey Decimal Classification scheme in the 1920s that African Americans were given their own class.
Were there other examples of this bias baked in?
Oh, sure. If you follow the Native American cultures as late as, in the 21st century, I believe the decimal classification scheme still categorizes Indian sand paintings and other cultural art like pottery, etc., under a different category than they would Vincent van Gogh or Rembrandt.
The Dewey Decimal System is updated by a Library of Congress advisory board. But change is slow in the library establishment, which is why the Sandinistas have to be a pain in the ass. It's interesting to think about this. I mean, I'm having mixed feelings because this is like a nostalgic thing that I think of from my childhood mainly, and it has this sort of complicated and dark history, or parts of the history are dark.
I wonder
as a historian, historians are always good at making sense and tying things up. How should I feel about this?
Flora, I'm the researcher, I'm the writer, and I published a book.
Not the psychiatrist.
What I write gets published. You're the reader. You make up your own mind.
I was having trouble making up my own mind. And this story made me want to think more critically about the information catalogs that I deal with most in my daily life, like the Google search bar, because I have read about bias in algorithms reminiscent of the Dewey bias.
This is, to me, much more difficult problem than Dewey, one single guy, reflecting his own personal biases.
So I called Rao Kambampati. He's a computer scientist at Arizona State University and president of the Association for the Advancement of AI. And I told Rao all about the Dewey Decimal System.
Yes, indeed. I agree that it is in a kind of an algorithm.
But he said that today's algorithms are more complicated. There may be programmers with biases, but on top of that, there may be problems in the data.
This brings us to the question of how do we control the biases that are inherent in the data? So just before I started talking to you, and for the heck of it, I typed to Google the word professor and in the image search. In the first 20 results, there were only 2 women.
Let me do this right now. I'm going to go to google.com. I'm going to type in professor.
If you look at the images, okay, you know, at least the one that I saw, there were the top 20, there were only 2 women.
Yes.
So now the interesting thing is, do you say this is biased or not? I don't really think that Google is doing anything other than putting a mirror to the data that is available in the wild. Individual people are putting pictures of professors they interacted with.
Google learns from and makes decisions based on the data we give it. That data, those photos, they don't come from Google. They come from many individuals uploading them to the web. The data comes from us. If I wanted to be an activist, like Sandy, for algorithms, is there anything I can do?
Not for algorithms, for data. What you can do is make sure that you and your friends basically introduce data. For example, if there are not enough pictures of female professors, just put lots more female professors on your Facebook pages, on your Twitter pages, and whatever else pages. And all Google is doing is crawling all of this information. That's it. That's one type of activism. The other type is actually change the society. Make sure that there are, in fact, more female professors. And then you would not have a problem.
Okay, so step one, create the world I want to see online, on the cloud. And then two, just change all of the systemic problems in society.
Exactly.
Every Little Thing is produced by Flora Lichtman with Christine Driscoll and Gofen Putubwele. Our senior producer is Catherine Wells. Our editors are Devin Taylor and Alex Bloomberg, scoring by Martin Crane. We were mixed by Dara Hirsch. Special thanks to Nicole Pasulka.